Welcome to the Drop Time Report. Turn up the volume and listen to amazing stories about big bucks and the hunters who harvested them. Here is your host, outdoor writer, Tracy Breen.
Welcome to the Drop Time Report. On this episode, we're going to have on Jeff Sturgis. He's the owner of Whitetail Habitat Solutions. He is a land manager, basically. I would call him a whitetail architect, if you will. He travels around to dozens and dozens of properties annually, helping landowners lay out a plan for food, cover, and water to better manage their land and pull in big bucks. The cool thing about Jeff is he specializes in habitat solutions for small property owners. So there's a misconception out there that you got to have a lot of money and you got to have a lot of property to manage for whitetails. And Jeff really makes his living managing smaller parcels of ground and teaching guys how to do that. So if you have a small parcel, hey, you might only have a few acres, you might have 40 or 80 acres. This episode is for you. But before we get Jeff on the phone, I'd like to thank my sponsors. Title sponsor, Redneck Blinds. Check out their fiberglass blinds. They have some great options. They also have some soft-sided blinds that are much less expensive. My favorite, the Gilly blind. Also, Fourth Arrow Camera Arms, the makers of the Final Rush shooting system that is perfect for deer blinds. It holds your crossbow or your gun steady when shooting. It's an awesome system. Windscent, the makers of vaporized deer urine technology. Morale Targets, love their high roller target. Huntworth Clothing, if you're looking for some hunting clothes and don't want to break the bank, check out huntworthgear.com. Pine Ridge Archery, makers of the Nitro Vane. Lucky Buck Mineral, my favorite deer mineral. Schaefer Performance Archery, they make a great arrow rest called the XV Arrow Rest. Illinois Connection Outfitters in Pike County, Illinois. The Outdoorsman's, they make great optics accessories such as tripods. They also make backpacks for backcountry hunting and wilderness athlete. If the new year is here, and obviously many of us need to shed a few pounds, check out their hydration drinks. Hydrate and Recover is my favorite. They also have nutritional supplements and mirror replacement as well. If you enter DROP10 at checkout, you can get a discount on your order. So let's go ahead and get Jeff on the show. Welcome to the Drop Time Report, Jeff. How are you?
Oh, I'm doing great, Tracy. It's great to be on the show.
Yeah, man, you're a busy guy. I've talked to you a lot in the last couple of days, and you're constantly out there improving deer hunting ground for clients, and you see a lot of property, and you hunt a lot yourself. And this year, your wife was able to kill a pretty cool buck that you guys called the split brow. And today I want to talk about that buck a little bit, as well as, you know, so kind of pick your brain on things, you know, guys can do to improve their ground. And I think a misconception among hunters is you got to have deep pockets to do some of these things. And that's just not correct, is it?
It is not correct. It really isn't. And what's cool, we'll talk about the split brow. That's on a 30-acre cover parcel. And we actually shot four bucks between 4 and 6 years old, and that was the king of them. You know, so Diane, that was her first buck, and she got it. And even the dollar spent on that property, we don't own it. You know, it's probably cheaper than someone being in a 35-week bowling league. Let's put it that way.
that's funny. So, you know, yeah, exactly. I like that. That you know, people need to put things in perspective, and that's a good analogy. I mean, a lot of it is elbow grease, right?
Yeah, and not that there's anything wrong with bowling, but it comes down to personal choices and priority. So,
So let's break down the history that you had with this buck called the split brow. How long you've been, you know, watching them and that sort of thing.
Well, that's a good question, because around here, like the first 2 to 3 years, unless there's something really unusual about that buck, they just don't stand out too much. And there's times where we'll see, you know, a few dozen bucks, and it just, unless they're the bigger ones or a little bit older, split brow buck, as a 3 year old, we could look back and try to look for a video of him, but he wasn't, I think at that time he would have been a basic, 8 point. And at that time, he, you know, was really just didn't stick out. He was a little bit lower antlers. And what's interesting around here, a lot of the bucks get high graded, meaning that if they have split G2s, a start of a drop time or something, they may get shot as a 2 or 3 year old. But split brow stuck out. And as a 4 year old, he started having a split brow time that was quite impressive for a split brow time. You know, it was at least four inches long on each split on the one side. And so I passed him up 3 times that year. And then when he was a 5 year old last year, really 2018, I really wanted to try to harvest them, ended up shooting another nice buck and then another one for muzzleloader. And so, you know, it's a lot of times we have 3 or 4 that I'd really like to shoot and go after. And although he was one of the bigger ones, it just didn't happen. And then this year he was a real focus. We started seeing him. He was off the property during the summer times. And we, like last year, the last picture we had of him was around February, and then he was gone until late September, early October this year. And then we see him all the time. And that's part of the management, is really trying to focus on mature bucks coming to the property during hunting season and not during the rest of the year. Because typically if they're there during the winter or summer, they're not going to be there during the hunting season. So we had the 3 year history with him. This year, instead of just one split brow, he developed 2 split brows. And
oh, wow.
So he really stuck out then, and I was able to see him in person. One time he was about 60, 70 yards away. I thought the doe was going to come to me, and he ended up cutting up the ridge with her. I actually circled around that night and went into a different stand hoping he'd come out of that bedding area, and he did. And I just, I have a lot of experience shooting big bucks, but I got a little rattled trying to find him in the binoculars, identify which one he was. He was coming through brush. By the time he gave me a shot, it was low light right in front of my stand. And when I really fully realized who he was, I have that full draw. He's behind some trees. I didn't shoot. And he walked away. And it just, one of those where you think, what in the world did I do? But bottom line, then Diane got a chance at him. And that made the season. It's funny, you know, people online will say, your wife shot a buck that you couldn't shoot. And, you know, kind of all in fun. But I'm so happy that she got him. I mean, that was very exciting for her. And so that's kind of the brief history with him, and that he was basically a hunting season buck. You know, like I said, the latest we saw him was right around early February for any of the years. But
he was 6.5, you're saying?
Yes. Yes. Yep.
And what did he end up scoring at 6.5?
You know, I haven't even scored him, but I would say right around 160, just familiarity with similar racks of his, maybe 155 to 160, something like that. Could have been 161, but yeah, somewhere around there.
Now, did she shoot him in, you know, one of the stands you were sitting in during gun season, or, you know?
No, it was on, you know, on the same property, but we have 11 tree stands and then 2 rednecks. And she actually shot him out of our redneck blind. That's one of the 6x7 ones. And she's actually sat in the last 2 years, just real quick, she sat in 26 different stands or blinds in like 90 sits. And a lot of those sits, she's walking up 30 to 35 minutes into a stand uphill. So when she gets to sit in the rednecks, those are by far her favorite. And she likes, she spreads everything out. She has her water. She got mad because we were in there shooting, you know, going doe hunting the other day, and she realized I drank her water. So she wasn't happy, but she gets everything laid out the way she wants, and she shot him out of the redneck, and it was like a 235-yard shot with a 243, and that's part of it. That was the seventh day of gun season, and we almost expected to shoot him during the middle to the end of the gun season, because we have low-pressure food plots. They're nothing fancy, and then we have low-pressure doe bedding. We don't spook that doe bedding out unless we, you know, shoot a deer in the food plot. We don't spook those food plots out. We take great care to allow that to happen every single day. So when we get into the middle of gun season and everyone else is pressuring the property, that creates an incredible opportunity. So that's why Diane was hunting that redneck and watching those food plots. And I think that was her first or second sit during the gun season where she saw the split brow and you know, was able to shoot him.
Now let's talk about your small property design a little bit. A lot of people have, you know, 10 to 40 acres, and, you know, what is it you do to maximize opportunity? Well, if there was a couple things, you know, I mean, obviously there's an endless amount of things, but if there's a couple things you would highlight, you know?
Well, it's really the entire movement, and you know, like the properties I hunt are 25, 40, and then that one's 30 acres. The one on the 40 only has 8 acres of cover. But what you're trying to do is the first thing when I meet with a client in the morning is to establish where we can put food on the property that maximizes the depth of cover adjacent to that food, meaning that a 40 acre parcel, and it's a quarter mile by quarter mile, and you put a 5 acre food plot in the middle, you only have 155 yards in depth of cover before you actually go off that property. That's not a good thing. Because what I find in general, that's just a mixed ag average parcel in the upper Midwest. Bucks are going to bed 200 to 400 yards off their afternoon food source. So what I'm trying to do is establish an afternoon food source and make sure that there's enough depth leading into the cover where you can actually have does that bed against that food and then bucks behind that. And that establishes that depth. And then the trick is you put the food there, you know, does are going to bed here and bucks are going to bed here. You have to make sure you can access it every time you go hunting and not spook that those deer in the food plots. It's almost, now I'm not saying it's a good thing, but it's almost better off to spook the bucks out of their distant and more remote bedding areas than it is to spook out the food plot and doe movement that goes into that food every single afternoon about an hour before dark. So we take great care into maximizing that depth and locating food where we can establish a foundation of movement on that food plot and on that food source on private land that extends throughout the entire season.
Okay. Now, do you prefer having several food plots on a small parcel or one big one or two big ones?
Really depends on the layout. Sometimes just because it's so small, you don't have a huge amount of locations to choose from. So that might dictate that you have one food plot. On the properties I have, we have two on the 25 acres, but they're real close to each other. We have three on the 52 acres that has 30 acres of cover. And they're just located in the only flat ground that we can put the food plots into that valley. And on the other property, that's a 40, where we have 8 acres of cover, we have two food plot systems that are separated by about 150 yards. And again, those are in the only flat areas that we can put food plots in and hide them too. So, you know, sometimes I like long, skinny food plots. But bottom line is you have to maximize that depth. And it gets into if you have a bigger parcel, like an 80 acre, if you put all the food plots to one end of the rectangle, then the far end of that 80 acres is not food supported. Because again, it goes back to those deer, the entire herd, those the bucks will want to move about 200 to 400 yards, and that's about it. So if you get 600 to 700 yards off that food plot, those bucks that would be bedding way back there, if there were any at all, are they even going to relate to that food plot on a daily basis?
Okay. So now, really, one of your special, go ahead.
I was just saying, so really it depends on the layout of the land. There's nothing cookie cutter for sure. And that's why I like a lot of open ground on parcels. So if you go to a 40 acre parcel and there's 10 acres of open ground, it's awesome because then you can put food plots maybe more where you need it and where you want it to go, as opposed to having a 40 acre hardwoods where you're left to bulldoze and move a lot and spend a lot to get those plots installed.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of your specialties is, you know, building bedding areas and in creating areas that bucks want to be. Why don't you highlight, you know, some of the things guys could do there to keep the bucks on their property as much as possible?
Yeah, so the cool thing about buck bedding is that a lot of times on private land, that's the last thing that you have to actually work on with a chainsaw and spend a lot of time on, because if you have that food source will locate doe bedding consistent for the entire season. And so if you work on doe bedding, then you'll be left with buck bedding cover behind that doe bedding. So obviously if it's open hardwoods, you'd want to take some steps to make those buck bedding areas. But a lot of times on mixed habitat, diverse habitat bedding, as long as you have the food to locate doe bedding and you keep that food consistent and you don't spook it out for the entire season, then you can count on those does living there for the entire season. And then the bucks will fall in line behind that. So buck bedding starts, and this is the same on public land. If you're looking for buck bedding, you have to find the major food source, find where does bed, and then the portion that's remote and left over is where the bucks bed. And it's the same on private land. where on private land, it's different because you establish a food plot, establish door bedding, and then the bucks will fall in line behind that. And so I, depending on their timber, if they have big mature timber and you're trying to create doe or buck bedding here, then I'm dropping down the undesirables, the non-marketable timber that are canopy trees, so that you get high stem count regeneration. It could be that you're completing a timber harvest in those locations, depending on the quality of the timber. And then if you have full timber size, where you have a lot of 4 to 5, 6, 7 inch diameter trees, there's a lot you can do with hinge cutting. And so hinge cutting is a great tool, but it's probably only appropriate on 20 to 25% of the lands that I go to. They're just, whether it's high canopy reduction, big canopy, timber harvest, or just simply hinge cutting in areas, there's a lot of ways to get the job done. And you're really looking at, you want to create hardwood regeneration, stem count, which equals side cover, meaning that deer can't see each other, they can't see you. And then a lot of browse. Deer have to have that browse during their daylight hours in their bedding areas, or it's not going to be so say, for example, you could have some big food plots, but then if you have open hardwoods next to it and there's no place for deer to get browse during the day, then they're not going to relate to that food plot on a daily basis. They have to be able to have some hardwood regeneration and browse, woody shrub tips, briars. And I include acorns, chestnuts into that too, hard mass, because it's all hard to digest. And so that even sets up the movement even more to their afternoon food sources that include a lot of green.
Okay. Now, what are the differences, you know, when between a doe bedding area and a buck bedding area?
Same thing as far as bedding. I don't believe there's, you know, like you make single beds or multiple beds. It's really just simply bedding area. And so the only difference to me between where bucks bed and does bed, and this is, you know, part of what I do is I scout client properties. And so, you know, like I said, I'll hit about 1,000 parcel. This will be my 1,000th parcel this year that I'll hit. And so part of that is just scouting deer bedding areas for a living. And so I get to see this pattern over and over again. What I find is bucks bed where it's remote, does bed where it's closer and to proximity of food. So really proximity to food and does is most important, even over the habitat. For example, I've seen some great mature buck bedding areas that were on a neighbor's property and stands of hardwood with a bunch of hills, where bucks could actually get out of the wind. They had some side cover with hills and topography where they could be hidden. And then the does were just crushed in out of the client property because they had so many does, and then they had thick switchgrass and hinge cutting area near the food plots. Now, if those does weren't there, maybe those bucks would have bed a little bit closer or on the land. And that was the trick on that property, is to try to allow enough room for bucks to bed. But really, it's based on proximity to food and stress. A mature buck, you find the older they are, the less they tolerate stress, does, fawns, young bucks. And I've even seen cases where on a 400-acre parcel in southern Michigan near Jackson, where they had so much food located within 100 yards of another food source, and there was no more than 100 yards of depth on the entire 400 acres, that when the bucks would get to 4 or 5 years old, they'd get shot a mile and a half away because they outgrew the stress level.
Okay.
Proximity is nothing. There's nothing different habitat-wise compared to does, fawns, and bucks. In fact, you find bucks because they're taking what's left over in remote. You find a lot of times they're bedding in areas that are actually not as great for bedding as far as where those does are taking over adjacent to the food source.
Now, because you're constantly designing, you know, food plots and properties, and you've been on the same parcels yourself for several years, do you typically know where a buck's bedding? Like, let's take the split brow. I mean, did you know his routine?
Yeah, and so that's a good question, because the parcels a lot of times are so small that the bucks are either bedding on the fringes or on the neighbors. And that could be said just about anywhere, because hardly anyone has, I mean, my average client, I have 50% of my clients are 60 acres or less. My average client has about 100 acres. I go to, you know, some that are larger. But in this case with the split brow, because we have cameras between bedding and the afternoon food sources, and those cameras are on mock scrapes, the mock scrapes really pull in the majority of the buck travel, does, and fawns in the area. So it really pulls them down to a single point. We get pictures. So on some of those mock scrapes, we'll get pictures of between 30 and 35 different bucks, where our neighbors might only see 15 or 20, but it's because we define, you know, they come into that area. So that's pretty easy. And we find the older the bucks become, the more defined they are to a specific area. So we might not know the exact bedding area is not very important. Even on public land, it's not very important. I just want to know they're coming from that 5 to 10 acre area or 15 acre area. And then we're hunting the funnels between bedding areas, between doe bedding areas, and between bedding areas and the afternoon food source. We're not really getting into the heart or the core of the movement, but we're getting onto that edge. And I love hills because then we can hunt benches and saddles and funnels that are created by the elevation change. And that narrows down the movement even more. But so a lot of times I know by proximity, I might have 5 cameras and 30 acres. I don't have 20 or 15, but when they're all on mock scrapes and water holes or just mock scrapes, then you get a high percentage of the deer action. And what's crazy is when they get older, you might only get pictures on 2 cameras for the one buck. And he's coming from that east side or that south side consistently. And you know, if he goes a half mile away, he's into open ag and cow pasture. And if he goes 150 yards over this way, he's in a hunter's stand that accesses all the time with an ATV. So it kind of slots him into an area where, you know, he's got to be in that 10 acres. I don't even care if he's on the neighbor's, because if the neighbor pushes into that area, he'll push him on my property more. And a lot of times those old bucks, you have to be so careful. You spook them one time, you know, the season's done. So that's where it goes back to, you know, the direction he's coming in, you know, where he's probably bedding. And as long as you maintain the consistency of the traction of the food plot, even if it's a 5 out of 10 food plot, but it's there all season long and you don't spook it out and you're not spooking the does that bed next to that food plot, then you can have great hunting the entire season on that movement. And with an older buck like that, you know what side he's coming in on too.
What is, if you're a guy with limited property, limited funds, what is your go-to food plot? What is it you like to plant? Is it clover or do you have some other blend?
Clover works pretty well down in southern Indiana, Illinois, southern Ohio, Kentucky, West Virginia, even Missouri, portions like that where it continues growing into December just because of the temperatures. But what I really like is a green blend. And so I put a video out this morning talking about the top 5 food plot failures. And when you get into soybeans, even brassicas, if you have a really wooded area, the deer will just demolish the brassicas and they can't take a lot of browsing pressure. But beans are even worse than that. Sugar beets are probably the worst. So if you had high pressure and the deer are going to eat, for one, you don't want to plant something in the summertime because then that establishes the doe and fawning foraging on those food plots. And so when you have your fall crops coming in, the does and fawns just annihilate the plots. So you don't have anything by October. Where if you let those does and fawns establish their summer fawning a half mile away, a quarter mile away, then you have the deer and the lack of focus on your land so that when you plant those fall food plots, let's say August 1st, then there's about a month and a half lag time when those deer really are not hitting those very hard. And I like blends of, I'll use, and so on my personal plots, I'm putting a brassica blend on one side and on the other side of the plot, and I'll do this with all the plots, but on the other side of the plot, I'm putting usually 50 pounds of oats with at least 100 pounds of forage peas per acre around August 1st, the same time I'm putting the brassicas in. And then I'm adding 200 pounds of winter rye right over the top of it in Labor Day. And if it's a really aggressive area, then a lot of times I'll just go with straight winter rye or winter wheat or both. I'll put 100 pounds out the end of August, and then I'll put 100 pounds out again, just broadcasting on top of the hand spreader about 3 weeks after that. And then 3 weeks after that, I'll put another 100 pounds. So I'm putting about 300 pounds of seed in that area. And really winter rye is about the most browse resistant or tolerant plant there is because it grows aggressively, even in cold temperatures. It'll germinate down to 37 degrees. So it's really, it's not a glamour crop, but if you keep it green and fresh and the deer hit it all season long, that's all you need for their afternoon food source. The next step up is if there's enough room, I'd plant corn. And if you have enough room after that, you're trying to build a herd, I'd put soybeans in. But corn and greens is outstanding. It's a really good 1-2 punch going into the season. And again, if it goes back to if you, and part of this complexity is if you have too many does, The first step in removing does isn't trigger control. It's actually eliminating your summer food source so that they can summer reside somewhere else. Yeah, I'd rather they're out in the neighbor's ag fields around here. That's healthier for them anyways, low stress, better nutrients, more volume. And then I keep my food plots in dirt and getting ready for the fall. I've been using a buckwheat rotation that I started back in the early 2000s for my food plots right now. And that works really well too.
That's interesting. You're the first person I've ever talked to that talks about, you know, really having a strategy for basically keeping the deer off your property much of the year. And it makes sense because the problem that many people have, like my own property, there's just piles of does and your food plots are going to be loved to death, basically, if you plant them in spring or summer.
Yeah. And you want to have does. And so I look at it like, you know, a way to, you have to have a balance. And, you know, obviously everyone knows you have to have a balance of deer, of does, buck ratios, everything. But the way I look at it is as your doe numbers increase, you get to a point where you maximize the number of bucks that you can have on the property. Meaning if you never have any does, you're not going to have as many bucks. But if you have too many does and you pass that point of balance, then as the number of does increase on your land during the fall, and especially this takes place midsummer to late summer, then the number of bucks you will have on your land decreases to a point where you can have so many does on your land that you do not have daylight buck movement except for during the rut. And there are so many properties that they're rut-only properties. I would say the more than the average property out there is just a rut-only property because with food plots and with inviting a lot of deer on your land, the does and fawns take up residence. There's no room left over for mature bucks, and except for during the rut for an intense 7 or 10 days, if we have the right weather, then you're not going to see a lot of bucks for the entire season.
Let's talk about water quickly. That's something you try to add that's, let's face it, pretty cheap. And when I interviewed Melissa Bachman here recently, she was talking about, you know, every one of her stands, she likes to have some type of water source nearby, and she hauls water in and goes to great lengths to have water available. And I remember you talking to me about that at one point. You know, what's your strategy there?
Yeah, so in the early 2000s, we started using tanks. We used a 55-gallon drum, cut it in half. We quickly realized that was not enough water. You do not want to have too much water on a property. For example, I might put a mock scrape at almost every stand location, but on a 40-acre parcel, you'd never want to have more than 2 to 3 water containers. And we might get away with 4, but we have 450-foot elevation changes in one 40-acre property too. So we have an upper half and a lower half. And so we can get away with 4, but really on most properties, you don't want one. So we have 9 stands on that. We have 4 water holes, and we probably have 8 mock scrapes. But you can put water, even if there's swamps or rivers or creeks, as long as the deer are bedded dry. Bucks that are going between dry bedding areas and then deer that are going between dry bedding areas and afternoon food sources, water is a great choice. And so what I find is water during the rut can be incredible. But overall throughout the season, water does not compare to a mock scrape. And you're only using water to define movement. And so I don't want people to ever fool themselves into thinking that water attracts more deer to your land. It just defines movement. And so let's say you had 10 water holes on 40 acres, then the power of one of those water holes is extremely diminished to where it's not very powerful at all. They can get water just about anywhere then. And so I'd prefer to, you know, on 80 acres, I might have 3 or 4 water holes on average. On 200 acres, you might have 5 or 6, depending on the layout of the land. And what I use and what we started using, you don't want to use anything less than, you know, 80 to 100 gallons. We use 110-gallon tanks from TSC. We found a huge aversion over the years, and this is going back in the mid-2000s, late-2000s, where if it was not buried, the deer that weren't used to it, say a mature buck that was coming in for the first time in October, he would shy away from it. We saw does that were pushed by dogs from other properties coming to one of those black water holes, and they just start stomping and blow at it and stare at it and then run around it. But we solved that, you know, 10, 12 years ago by actually burying them below ground level. And so that accomplishes a few things. We put them in the shade because that conserves water. We don't like the kiddie pools and flatter water holes because the surface area allows for a lot more evaporation. So that 110-gallon tank from TSC for $75 is a great product because it's 30 inches deep, 3 feet by 4 feet. There's not as much surface area for evaporation. You put it in the shade, put it below ground level. A lot of times you can put it into a slight hill. And so you can collect rainwater. And really, if you think of that tub as being the bottom of the puddle, then it works extremely well. Again, though, you'd think they'd hit it in the early season because it's hot out or during the summer. They really don't. The activity on the water holes just picks up extremely, really intensifies during end of October, November, early December, as long as it's not frozen. But then like the mock scrapes, we don't have any water holes without mock scrapes nearby. And what's interesting, they'll come to the water hole and then hit the mock scrape, or they'll hit the mock scrape and then the water hole. But a lot of times they hit the mock scrape without hitting the water hole, and they'll hit our mock scrapes 365 days out of the year. So for bucks, does, fawns, everything. One just real quick tip, the water holes. You know when the rut's taking place when they all of a sudden start hitting the water holes in the morning and midday hours. Because typically deer, they'll leave dry bedding areas in the afternoon. They'll go to their afternoon food source. On the way there, they'll get a drink. Then they feed on green all night, even if they're out in the farmer's fields eating old alfalfa at the end of October. But they crave green. So that's why they don't hit water holes very much in the morning, September, August, July. But as soon as the rut picks up and those bucks are moving a lot and they develop a thirst, doesn't matter what the temperature is. It could be very cold, almost frozen. Those bucks are hitting the water end of October, and it'll happen about between the 20th and the 24th. We'll all of a sudden start getting water hole pictures at 11, 2 o'clock in the afternoon, which, and then before that time, it was only in the afternoon. So you can really tell when the pre-rut hits by the extreme pickup on the use of the water holes the end of October.
Do you have any tricks for keeping those water holes open when it's getting cold?
No, I don't. Someone told me to put a jug of salt in there, and I guess the warmth from the salt, you're not actually adding salt to the water. It's just inside like a 1 gallon milk jug.
Yeah, milk jug.
Yeah. I've heard that. I've had people tell me about solar panels with heaters that they use for cattle. But what's crazy is right now we have a lot of deer that just go by and they'll paw at the water hole. And that's where I find in December, January, if you do have open water, it is a magnet because they can't get water right now. You know, normally deer don't need to take a drink for weeks at a time. They really don't. But they get all their moisture from the vegetation they eat. Well, right now everything's dry. You know, corn is 10-12% moisture. Beans are, really lacking. That's where the green food sources shine right now. Brassicas are 80% moisture. Clover is even high in moisture if they can dig down to it right now. But bottom line is there's not a lot of moisture around right now. So if you can keep it open, it's a magnet.
Okay. Yeah, that's interesting. And any other, quick tips for the average Joe? What do you feel like the, if a guy's on a budget, food plots are expensive, what's the magical size as far as food plots? You don't want them too big or too small. What do you think the just right size is in a perfect world?
I find that, when we, our 25-acre parcel that we developed this year was mostly all wooded, and we put in about 1.25 acres of food plots. And we didn't plant them till August. We didn't have any deer on there until that time. We actually didn't bulldoze them until August. And that works really well when you don't have an army of does and fawns there all summer. There's some lag time. On the 40s around here, then we're putting out about 2 acres, 2.25, 1.75. And we find that that's enough to last the entire season. And that's even if 15 to 20 deer on average are hitting those almost on a daily basis the entire season. But we're not using, like if I put beans out in those plots, they'd be down to the dirt by August, September, and they would be useless. If it was all in brassica and I put those August 1st, that brassica would be down to the dirt by November, mid-October, and they wouldn't be used. But because we use the diversity blend with oats and rye and peas on one side, and there's a lot of fresh young candy for them to eat, we even put late planted beans in there, then the deer will focus on that. They allow the brassicas to get some good volume on them. before they start hitting them the end of October. And so really it's not like a certain planting. It's a combination of plantings I'm always trying to tweak so that deer have something on one side of the plot while they're allowing the other side to grow. That's why we add another layer of rye around Labor Day. So it continues the attraction on the one side while letting the high volume of Nebraskas become established. And so by doing that, then a couple acres out of 40 is a significant amount. And you have to keep in mind, deer feed five times in a 24-hour period. So if you're in a big wooded setting with no ag, they're going to hit your food plot sometimes five times in a day, and you're going to need a lot more food plot. If you're in a mixed ag area where you have quality browse back in the woods, then they'll feed on quality browse for feedings number one and two, which would be early morning around noon. And then their third feeding of the day is on your food plots, then twice at night out in the ag fields. So they're really only hitting your food plots 1 to 1.5 times out of five per day. Or in a big woody section, they're hitting at five. So when I was in the UP in Michigan, I had 8 acres of plots. I had 1/3 as many deer, and the food plots had a hard time making it through November to December. Down here in Southwest Wisconsin, 3 times more food and 6 acres of plot, or 3 times more deer and 6 acres of plots on the old land we had. And that food would last all the way to February and March. And so it's because they had the complement of the ag field to take the pressure off the plots. So neighboring plot, you can take advantage of if your neighbor has plots and they're spooking them out. They become nocturnal plots. Your plots become daylight, and you want the deer to leave your plots after dark and go over to your neighbors and feed twice during the night.
Are you adding, one of the big things these days is adding trees, chestnut, acorn, those kind of things. Are you adding those to property, or don't you really worry about it?
I like the complement to the diversity. Something that I firmly believe in is acorns, chestnuts. They're hard to digest, similar to corn. They're a lot more similar to woody shrub tips, hardwood regeneration, than they are apple trees and food plots. And so I love keeping hard mass back in the woods. You never want to have a property that's all oak, but an oak can be a great complement to daylight browse in bedding areas. And then out by food plots, I love planting crab apple trees and apple trees based on what is the best type of planting in a specific area, and then multiple types, whether you're planting persimmons, down southern areas, southern Indiana, southern Illinois, and then pear trees, apple trees, crab apple trees, anything soft mass. They're never going to be the food source that directs traffic and provides that foundation of movement every day of the season, but those soft mass trees can be a huge complement to the afternoon movement around food plots. And it really good. So that can just really heat up your food plot use. And then the daylight browse is heavily complemented by acorns and chestnuts. So I'd keep hard mast in the woods near bedding areas, and then soft mast in the food plots. And that will allow you to continue that movement. For example, if you have a bunch of apple trees and a few small food plots back in their bedding areas, in theory, why do they have to leave? So they can stay there till dark, feed on their high quality food sources, and then leave those bedding areas after dark. Where I'd rather create that movement where they have plenty of browse in their bedding areas, and then they want to hit the soft mass and great food plots and move up to 400 yards a day to do that every single day of the season.
Okay. Why don't you leave us in closing just to kind of motivate people? I would love to hear maybe a success story from a client, a guy who wasn't really killing good bucks on his property, and you came in and kind of showed him what to do, and ta-da, a few years later, it all paid off.
Well, here's the thing about that. There's just so many endless clients. And one of the things that I want to stress real quick, and I'll tell you one little story, but is that you can change your hunting overnight. You can literally change it from one season to the next. This does not take years to develop at all. And that's where the food plots, hunting correctly, hunting like a predator, really putting some mature buck hunting tactics into your habitat and hunting design is so critical. And the lowest hole in the bucket of any of this is how you hunt the land. So you cannot have any type of habitat improvements that overcome your lack of hunting effort or hunting practice.
Too much pressure.
Yeah, you're putting pressure on it, the habitat improvements actually make worse because you invite more deer from the neighborhood onto your land only to spook more deer. So your property becomes nocturnal. So I had, so I get a lot of people that turn the property over just in a short period of time. There's one, and we'll just, I always use a fake name of Billy. So we'll just say his name was Billy.
Okay. Old Billy. Old Billy.
Yeah.
Billy Ray Cyrus, we'll call him. Exactly.
But he's up Tigerton area, Wapaka, up in Wisconsin. And he had around 300 acres, and he had a huge amount of corn and beans that he was planting on his land and clover plots, seeing just a ton of does and fawns and small bucks. And he knew he could do something to turn it around. And it was crazy. His caretaker, which I won't even name him, we'll just say his caretaker, he lived off to the side, and his caretaker was shooting all the 150, 60, 70 inch bucks. And he lived in a little swamp, 5 acre parcel, and he could almost shoot them on his backyard. But it was because he had the thick cover off to the side that was out of the doe movement, fawn movement, and pressure of the property. So Billy, I had him shrink his food plots. I had him get rid of almost all of his summer food, had him thicken up the woods so he could actually hold does next to that food source. And then his property was an MFL, so he couldn't do a lot with the property in general. But what happened was, is instead of all those does and fawns just living anywhere and everywhere on the property all summer long, he was actually on the online forums complaining when the QDMA forums used to be on there and complaining, okay, about, you know, Sturgis told me to get rid of the summer food. I'm not seeing any bucks. And he wasn't, you know, totally abandoning the strategy, but by fall, he had the most bucks he'd ever seen. He had twice as many bucks as he'd ever seen. And they ended up shooting 184 inch with a muzzleloader. It was the biggest buck they'd ever seen, shot. And so he found, and I kept telling him over and over again, you know, Billy, just wait. Those bucks will come. And I was getting a little nervous, but they all start coming in because where bucks are at during the summertime is typically where they're not at during the fall. So a lot of people get really misled that they have all these bucks on their land during the summertime, and they just think that they go nocturnal and that they're still around. And really, they just leave and they go about a mile and a half away, and they stay on someone else's property during the fall. And that's what Billy found. All those bucks that he saw driving around the roads in the evening looking for bucks, they all ended up on his land. And he was the one daylight buck property in the area, because what I find is there's 5% or less of all deer parcels that have daylight buck focus, especially mature buck focus, in the entire neighborhood. There's very, very few parcels, because most are being pushed, most are being pressured, most don't have quality fall food, quality fall cover, most are overrun by does. When you X out all those negatives, then you're left with very, very few properties that are the true herd influencers in the area and that actually attract the focus of mature bucks. And Billy, from that time on, they've had outstanding hunting, and that goes with, you know, all the clients that do the work. It's amazing. I had one client that took 5 years. All of a sudden, I get a, his name's Steve in Lower Michigan. I get a picture of a 155-inch 10-point that he shot. And this was like 5 years after I was there. I hadn't heard from him. And he said that he and his brothers kind of argued after I left on what to do. 4 years later, they decided to put the plan in. Within 1 year, they shot that 155-inch buck, which is by far the biggest buck that ever saw, you know, seen in the property. And that was a 60-acre property, 50-acre property, somewhere around there. So that's the key, is that all these habitat improvements, the designs that people put on their land, they have to allow that hunter and landowner to be able to move through the property without spooking deer and actually get into stand locations behind bedding in the morning, closer to food sources in the evening, hunt the transition areas with mock drapes and water holes during the middle of the day, during the rut, and really establish that core area on their property where they never let their sight, your scent get into. And you can turn things around overnight, even if you don't have a lot of money to chainsaw trees, put in food plots, and put in expensive food plots, just a little bit of green and a lot of hunting pressure removal. And it is crazy. And it doesn't mean you should only hunt during the rut. I think a good person, you should be able to hunt from day one to the end. You know, Diane's hunting right now. You know, she's sat last night. She saw 6 bucks and 8 does. And, you know, we shot our bucks this year early November, and then the 7th day of gun season, the 9th day of gun season, and then basically the 12th, 13th day of gun season into the muzzleloader season on that small property. And it's because very few properties have that low pressure food source cover and don't experience hunting pressure in the neighborhood. So it's a very small percentage. And if you can do that, it's just incredible. You need the food source to establish that daily movement all hunting season long. But outside of that, it doesn't even have to be that, you know, a 10 out of 10 for food. And if you maintain that all season long, it is amazing what can happen. And when the clients do that, I have a client down in the Boscobel area in Southwest Wisconsin. He has 40 acres, not a lot of resources, only about an acre of food, two water holes, bunch of mock scrapes. He's cut bedding areas. He's seeing 4 to 7 year old bucks, multiple, 4 or 5 of them every single year that he hunts. He shot 2 of them this year. He has them all named, and it is incredible. It's just property alone all season. And he's in the middle of a bunch of guys trying to do the same that have 200 acres, 300 acres, and they're not shooting those big bucks because they hunt haphazardly. And when you get those older bucks, you can't afford to apply too much hunting pressure.
So how many days, and then I'll let you go, but how many days, you know, you have a 40-acre parcel or a 20-acre parcel, how many days are you hunting it? I mean, consistently saying, you know, one of the trends here is you don't want to overpressure a property.
Right.
And so, you know, how many days are you hunting it?
I would say that for me personally, I'm shooting my mature bucks every 6 or 7 sets, you know, that. So if I sat 14 times in the season all the way through the end of November, then I'm going to shoot 2 mature bucks. Diane, I believe she's sat around 90 times the last 2 years, but that's 90 times our season. Like this year, I think it was 8th of September it opened. So we're going to be at 4 months old here really quick. And it'll go for about 4.5 months. So you think about it, she's spaced out 90 sits, but that's been over 9 months. And so of hunting over 2 years. So you look at, she's applying about 10 sits per month. And that would be 10 half day, you know, 3 hour sits, 4 hour sits. So, you know, really, I would say 2 to 3 times a week you can get away with on a 40 if you have multiple stands, different access routes in and out. But we're really spacing out our hunts in clusters to where when the weather is good, we might sit 2-3 days in a row, and then we're not hunting it for 4 or 5 days because the weather's bad. And then we might hit it again 1 or 2 times. And then we're really letting the weather, you know, someone could shoot a big buck on a warm day, big winds, bad weather day. But, you know, I'll bank on the 90% or 80% success rates on the really cold, good days to hunt. And so we're doing that too. It's not just, so we're applying that consistent pressure, but, you know, it might be someone could hunt every weekend almost. You know, they're hunting 2 days, 3 days, and then they're getting off the property for 5 or 6 if they're just lightly skipping around the property. And if they're not, so if someone's spooking deer off the food plots every time they hunt, then they should wait 3 or 4 weeks before they come back because the property, you know, food plots can't take that kind of pressure. And so it really depends on how someone's hunting and how lightly they can tread on their land.
Okay. Good to know.
But consistent.
Well, cool. Why? Go ahead.
I was just saying, but consistent. You know, someone can always apply consistent hunting pressure over the entire season. There should never be like I have to wait all October to get to November to hunt. You should be able to take some consistent shots during early October, mid-October, the October lull, those kind of periods. If you're hunting it right and you're really learning to manage your hunting pressure that you apply in the land.
Cool. Well, I appreciate you taking the time today. And ATA shows next week, so maybe I'll bump into you. And
yeah.
Good luck with your busy season coming of traveling around the country and teaching people about deer.
Oh, sure. Thank you very much. I can't wait to, actually. I love getting on client property. So.
Very cool. Well, have a great day.
Thanks. You too, Tracy.
Yeah. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Hopefully after listening to this episode, you've gained a few ideas, a few things that you'd like to do on your property this coming spring or summer. And as Jeff said throughout the podcast, many of these things can be done on small parcels of property, and they can improve a piece of property relatively quickly. So if you do some of these things this coming spring, you're going to reap the reward come fall. I'd like to thank everyone for listening this week. To learn more about me, visit my website, tracybreen.com. I use that website to book speaking engagements at Wild Game Dinners. I also use it
to do giveaways. So if you'd go there, TRACYBREEN.com, TracyBreeN.com, I'm going to give away a couple packs of Grim Reaper broadheads in this episode. I've worked with Grim Reaper a lot of years. They're my favorite broadhead. So go to my website, shoot me an email. Just go to the contact page, shoot me an email. The first few guys that do that, I'll send you a pack of broadheads. Until next time, have a great day.